Bubba Wallace here from 2311 Racing. On the track, my car's look is everything. But today, I'm talking about more than just paint schemes. I'm talking about my favorite games at Chumba Casino. Check out exclusives like Stampede Fury and my own King Croc Fury. It's just as wild as my car looked in Texas. With over 200 games and new ones weekly, play for free at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
The fifth column, basically traders.
Yeah.
You know, like an organized group of traders within the country. And
traitors. Not traders.
Not traders with a D, but for him,
traitors and traitors, actually.
They're one and the same.
That's actually a really good title for this podcast. Traders and traitors. Donald Trump was elected on a wave of frustration over high prices, but his signature economic policy has been to raise tariffs on everything from coffee to cars, on countries from China to Canada. To give you a sense of how arbitrary and capricious his policy has been, just over the weekend, he added a 10% tariff on Canadian goods just because they used Ronald Reagan's voice in an ad promoting free trade. How did we get here? Why are we taxing cars, but not computers? I invited my friend Joey Politano on the show to talk with me about it. He's an economics writer. He's also a contributor here at The Argument, but he's best known for his great Substack, Apricotas, where he breaks down economic data and forecasting. We talk about where Trump's tariff obsession came from, the fantasy of returning to a 1950s manufacturing economy, and I try to get Joey to steel man the other side. Why are people so obsessed with tariff policy? Why does protectionism seem so popular in some political circles? My name is Jerusalem Dumsis. I'm the editor and founder of The Argument, a magazine dedicated to revitalizing liberalism for the 21st century. On this show, we bring together everyone from socialists to conservatives to talk about the most important issues of the day. The argument is against subtweeting. We state our opinions clearly, and we confront our opponents directly. For an ad-free version of this episode, you can become a subscriber at theargumentmag.com. Joey Politano, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me on.
You are best known for being a contributor to The Argument, but you do have another gig, right? What do you do?
I write the newsletter Apricotas Economics, which is a data-driven newsletter all about econ. Hopefully people have seen my charts. Those are my pride and joy.
My favorite part about your charts is how easy it is to steal them and pretend like you made them yourself.
Mm.
Yeah.
Especially if you're a wannabe candidate for Canadian Prime Minister who's not gonna...
Who? Macro aggression to the French Canadian people. Poilievre,
whatever it
you're
is.
Saying it even worse now. Iconic.
This
he's watching this.
Listen, if he's watching this,
don't steal
him,
my charts.
Don't steal my charts.
Yeah,
it's a very funny story. So at some point, I've tweeted a lot of charts about like the U.S. economy compared to other countries, and one of them compared the U.S. to like all the G7 countries, including Canada, and Canada was the worst performer in GDP growth since COVID, or GDP per capita rather, and America was the best performer. And Poilievre tweeted this and be like, "Look at what Justin Trudeau has done to this country." But the part that was insulting was that like it cropped the entire bottom of the chart, which is the part where I say that I made it. Mm-hmm. And I was like, that's crazy.
So I think Celeste is having to do a massive watermark on all your charts so they're unreadable.
I honestly, it made me sympathetic to those people who put like their account name in the like right center of the chart.
Yeah.
Or like, I think artistically it kind of ruins it, so I won't do it. I'm not that. But
it does. And also, like, your charts are great. We're going to have a couple of them flashing on screen. But what does a Apricotas mean?
So it is a Latin word. Mm-hmm. And it means sort of like a sunniness. Mm-hmm. And so the original pitch when I was trying to come up with like a name for the newsletter, I wanted to merge this idea of like the sun as a metaphor for truth is like something pretty common in reporting. And that's why people talk about like sunshine laws or whatever.
Sunlight is the best disinfectant.
Right, exactly. Sunlight's the best disinfectant.
I prefer Clorox. Clorox. I should be doing a free spawn con.
But the other thing was just sort of this ideal of optimism.
Mm-hmm.
I do think that like the long run, a long run view of the economy is inherently somewhat optimistic, that like things have been improving for humanity because of economic growth for now like 190 years pretty consistently. and that like it's a reassuring part of studying the economy to feel like you're having this kind of forward progression.
Yeah.
And to watch it happen. And obviously that's not to like say everything is hunky-dory and there's no problems and everything's solved. But
I
that,
like the like don't cancel me disclaimer that you just did.
Oh yeah, of course. Yeah,
gotta do it.
Of course.
Every time you hear that, like it's like, oh, that guy's like, oh, well, someone on the internet's gonna get mad.
Someone on the internet is gonna be like, say it. Long run GDP may have increased since the Neanderthals, but are we better off?
Are you indifferent between being a Neanderthal and being Joey?
I'm sure there's someone
right
on Twitter is gonna be indifferent. But that's why my logo. So if you look at the logo, and I think people it's very well designed, but it's like a sun that's sort of transformed into a pie chart.
I don't think I realized that's what it was.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. It's very subtle.
Yeah.
And it's
perhaps too subtle.
Well, no, let's not criticize.
No, I absolutely love your newsletter. And I think that like of everyone who is tracking tariffs, not only are you like the person I go to like see what's going on, but you are just such a great translator of what's happening to people who are not experts in trade policy or economics. So that's why I asked you to come on the show. So let's start at the very fundamental part. What is a tariff?
A tariff is a tax on imports.
It's a controversial definition, isn't
and
it? No, but isn't it?
It is in the sense that people will want to distinguish between tariffs and other forms of taxes. It's one of the few that in English we give like a separate name, you know. People talk about like sales tax, excise tax, income tax, but we don't talk about import tax. We talk about tariff.
Why?
This is just like the long history of, I think it's the specifics of how the first trade systems were created, that we relied a lot on tariff revenue. And so they're perceived as something wholly different. Like the income tax is a much more modern invention than like the tariff in American history. But they are a tax on imports. Fundamentally, if you imagine it mechanically, you buy something from the European Union, it gets on a big cargo ship somewhere in the Netherlands, it travels across the Atlantic, it docks in Elizabeth, New Jersey, and at Elizabeth,
everyone
New
knows
Jersey,
that name when you're tracking your little packages.
It's a big port. Listen, yeah. It's one of the most important ports on the
Sorry.
East Coast.
Nothing but respect for Elizabeth, New Jersey.
Nothing but respect for Elizabeth, New Jersey. And in Elizabeth, basically for it to be released, you have to provide a bunch of data to Customs and Border Protection. And then they will assess based on the contents, the country of origin, the type of product, and the relevant statutes, including part sometimes like the company, what the tariff is.
So I want to ask a little bit about like, the actual mechanics of this a little bit, because like, first of all, obviously CBP is not going through every single shipment and like touching all of the bananas and produce and things that are being brought into this country and looking at it. So like, and we know, for instance, a lot of drug smuggling happens through ports, like not usually happening as people are carrying them over the border, as, you know, a lot of Republicans like to talk about. It's often coming through ports of entry in a way that indicates that, like, perhaps we're not actually quite very good at, like, assessing what's coming into the country. So, like, what exactly is going on when people are shipping to the United States? It gets to a port and they're supposed to assess an import duty.
Yeah. In normal times, this is mostly a formality, you know, so you buy a bunch of stuff from the European Union. You have to report this for data collection and security purposes because they want to prevent that kind of like drug smuggling or like the worst kind of avoidance. Or more commonly, it's like, hey, you got this from Russia and you're putting it through Germany and you send it to the United States and they don't, you know, we're not letting in Russian stuff. And so we want to assess that. But the volume of container ships that enter into the United States is way outside the bounds that you can check each one of them individually. And so the system that you end up relying on is like, we are going to inspect some of them, you know, so you're going to, you have a risk of random inspection. And more broadly, you have like a corporate level, a risk of like backward liability. So you imported a bunch of stuff from Vietnam And then come to find out it's actually from China, and mm-hmm. the tariffs on China are higher than the tariffs on Vietnam, where the U.S. government is going to come back and say, you owe us ABC XYZ dollars.
And did they do like this. A multiplier or a fee?
And right, there's a fee and there's interest and all of that good stuff. One of the more famous cases of this was there's an instance, I'm forgetting the auto manufacturer. I think it might have been Ford. Mm-hmm. But they put like jump sheet seats in the back of a pickup truck to argue that it was an SUV. Mm. And so it would face a lower tariff as an SUV than it would as a pickup truck. And they were doing this for years, and then the U.S. government, you know, brought a suit and was like, no, these are pickup trucks. Look, people just take the seats out as soon as they get into the United States. And they eventually, like, lost that suit. And so that's the, like, a protection mechanism. But it's also worth noting that this is the complexity in assessment mm-hmm. that you've had over the last year is orders of magnitude mm-hmm. higher than anything we've had before in American history. And CBP is not fully equipped to, like, do all this. Mm-hmm. So, example for washing machines. If you bought a Korean washing machine today, mm-hmm. you would have to assess the value of the steel within the washing machine, the value of the aluminum within the washing machine, and what percent of that, the rest of the washing machine, what country it's from to determine the tariff rate. So you have like washing machine that is 10% steel, you have 50% tariff on the 10%, and it's 5% aluminum, so you have 50% on the 5% that's aluminum. And then you're left with the remaining 85% value of the washing machine. Because it's from South Korea, you have a 15% tariff, so it's 15 on the 85. And now
and
you have a situation
those
of like
officers for arithmetic skills.
Right. Yeah, okay. You know, we're running this
we're
through
only
a
best
calculator.
And brightest at CBP.
Every single I'm not I don't want to like impugn the values of our great patriot civil servants. But what I'm saying is that this is like not precedented. Mm-hmm. Very rarely would you have this kind of, oh, what's the steel value of this good? Let me assess a tariff based on that. And then very rarely would you also have this like differential tariffs based on country of origin. Mm-hmm. If it's from Vietnam, it gets a 19% tariff. If it's from South Korea, it gets a 15% tariff. So now you have to enforce correctly, what is the amount of steel in this? What is the mm-hmm. amount of aluminum? Where did it actually come from?
And how are they doing this? What are they? Are they just guessing?
Well,
what's
they're like I said, all these companies have to report
I mean, like,
this stuff.
So the company they're just taking it on face value. The companies are doing.
They're not taking it on face value. They have right, enforcement penalties, and companies. So like Whirlpool, which mm-hmm. is the American, mostly American, washing machine manufacturer mm-hmm. is like bringing forward a lawsuit alleging that there's like foreign companies are underestimating the value of their washing machines. And this is creating unfair competition for them. And I don't want to like comment on the specifics of that lawsuit, but it's like, that's the kind of enforcement mechanism you have at another level where it's like private companies are on the hunt for this kind of stuff because they want their protection.
Yeah.
But no, it is. I am certain mm-hmm. that there are large numbers of underreported value mm-hmm. transactions or like mislabeled countries of origin, and I have received many a anonymous DM from mm-hmm. people who are like, I work in the auto industry and we have a plant in Canada and we're just lying and saying that the stuff is from Canada, because right now if you can get a car in a car
wow.
part from Canada
yeah.
where it is zero tariffs, and if you get it from the European Union it's 15%. And so like that it's very hard to estimate how large that is mm-hmm. but that's like the secondary consequence of expanding the system
yeah.
so broadly and making it so complex in a way that we haven't before.
So we've already gotten to like the second order consequences mm-hmm. or like second order problems of like trying to even assess tariffs. So I want to like get back to the first order. So you wrote a line that really stuck with me for a while. You wrote, proponents of universal tariffs proponents of these universal tariffs do not see trade as an engine of economic prosperity that can be harnessed for good. Rather, they see it as an ugly byproduct of necessary production processes. Factory sludge dumped into a pristine river that governments ought to strictly curtail. And this line was interesting because it's like, I think that like as a step back, you know, there's a lot of arguments about specifics. I mean, there are, I believe, like tariff policy that both of us would probably be fine with or even supportive of specific targeted tariffs that we might understand the purpose of those existing. But that's kind of different than what's happening right now. Right now, we're seeing broad-based tariffs not just in manufacturing sectors or things that are going or secondary goods that are going into manufacturing that we want to bring back and reshore in the United States, but also, as you have famously gotten upset about, bananas, coffee, things that America does not and for geographic reasons will not make in large quantities unless we have some sort of a, I don't know, like climate shifting catastrophe slowly unwielding. But I think that the thing that's interesting about the point you're making here is that there is a sense among a group of people, including the president of the United States and some think tanks, which we're going to talk a lot, like American Compass, and other folks who have become not just concerned with, you know, open free trade with no protections, but really don't believe that you can have trade in a way that is actually beneficial for the country that we live in and other people. Like, the idea of this, like, this positive sum relationship in which I'm exchanging some money and I'm getting some stuff in return, like, that is not inherently, that is inherently suspect.
Mm-hmm. And I think the specific thing talking about, like, universal versus sectoral tariffs,
mm-hmm.
I think people can intuit an argument about we need to put tariffs on cars
mm-hmm.
or batteries or whatever because we want to build those things in America. I think the vast majority of economists, and I put myself in this group, would disagree with that, would still think it's bad policy, but it at least has a concrete beginning, middle, and
it's an argument. It has the form
it's
of
an argument. You know
claim,
what I mean?
Evidence, impact.
We should have more domestic production of ABC. To get more domestic production, we should reduce foreign imports. To reduce foreign imports, we should use a tariff.
Raise the prices.
But the thing that that piece was written before the Trump administration, before the second Trump administration, and it was against these sort of proposals for, at the time, what Trump wanted was like a 10% universal tariff on everything.
Mm-hmm.
And we haven't gotten quite in that. We've gotten a much more complicated system. But the whole point of that is just saying a 10% tariff doesn't actually have a strategy end goal. It's just that we should consume less imported things and produce more domestically. But there's no, like, more of what.
Mm-hmm.
It's just the raw idea is that any form of trade is suspect.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing that I think gets to the coffee and banana tariffs, the reason I complain about that so much is because it's so easy to exempt things.
Yeah.
It's so, so easy. You just add, like, another number code in the Federal Register. And you would exempt stuff that is obviously beneficial to Americans. And this is sort of the canary in the coal mine to me. It's like they don't want to exempt even stuff that is obviously beneficial to Americans because they have this, like, harebrained idea that all trade is inherently suspect.
And by obviously beneficial, what you mean is that we can't, like, the only way to get bananas is to bring them in. So it's like either it's either no bananas or foreign bananas.
And and they're like, but I think the sophisticated... I did air quotes. The sophisticated
for our audio listeners.
For the audio listeners, I did air quotes. But people who are like, oh, well, you should just, like, consume, you know, pawpaws that are, or like oranges. Like, I've had people say this sort of stuff to me where it's just, it's not even just the idea that you can benefit from trade is anathema.
Mm-hmm.
But also even obvious cases where you can benefit from trade, you shouldn't do it out of, like, self-sufficiency, like, nationalistic and patriotic.
I find it really interesting, Lily, how, like, it honestly feels super un-American in some respect. Like, the idea that consumer goods can bring you joy is, like, one of the, I think it's in the Constitution of the United States. It's, like, number, under Article 1.
It's like, third or fourth in the Bill of Rights.
Yeah, yeah. It's a little right. Like, it's, like, consumer goods can and will bring you joy. And that's what you have to attest to when you get naturalized as a citizen of the United States. And, I mean, but like, more seriously, just, like, it is a very, very normal belief that things can help make you happy. And we are at a place in our, like, development as a country where, like, we're so rich that we also have the problem that some things can make you less happy, like TikTok or, like, smartphones. But, like, that's not, like, the normal thing. Most, like, this chair, I like the color. It's very comfortable. We needed a chair so that we could have this lovely conversation in my living room with no cameras around us, you know? But, like, other things like clothing that people want to wear, like being able to write letters on, like, nice stationery. Some people enjoy that. Like, these are, like, that you can talk about negative externalities of, like, overconsumption without losing the core point that, like, the things that people want to buy with their money are often reflective of either values, preferences that are actually really important to them, or at least bring them joy in some way. And like, what is the point of all the money that you are able to amass as a country if you can't use it to buy the things that make you happy?
Yeah, I have so many things to think of in response to that. The first is that it is a weirdly like dictatorial pro-investment ethos. The way I think about it is like people, when they were pressed into buying like war bonds, the idea was like, well, you can't have, no, I'm serious, it was like,
no,
you can't
it.
Have coffee
yeah.
because we need to send coffee to the people in Normandy right now, and so can you please like shut up about wanting coffee.
Okay,
and that
like,
was like a valid point in World War II.
That seems like a good point, actually. I don't know. I think I'm leaving you here.
But like after World War II, they were like, okay, we're done with that now. You know, you can
like
go
back to...
Like
the sacrifice was for a purpose.
The sacrifice for
a
purpose. The point I think that they are trying to attune is like this sacrifice is for some sort of reindustrialization agenda. And the kind of crazy thing is, one, they don't have a coherent large-scale picture of like, what are we... want to build in the United States, which sectors would we like to specialize in, which industries are we most important. They're kind of working backwards from like what tariffs do we want to put on things. The secondary thing is like in Trump's first term, he did a really big trade war. That trade war was almost entirely concentrated with China, which at the time was a much larger trade partner, direct trade partner for the United States than it is today. And that trade war, there was like a clear fear that you could see in people's eyes, that they were like, we are doing this nationalistic project to curtail a great power competitor. We think that China is a threat to the United States. We want to make things worse for China, but that will make things worse for the United States too. And we have to like be conscious of the fact that people might have a backlash. The example that I give is they would come up with these giant lists of things that imported from China that they were going to hit with tariffs. And always, always, always absent from the list was Christmas ornaments and children's toys. And those are, we are extremely dependent on imports from China for those types of goods. It's something in the 90 to 99%.
I do buy too many Christmas ornaments. Can I just say that? I'm a Christian. I love Christmas.
Look.
You should be reusing those ornaments.
No, I think people, what do you mean? Of course they're reusing the ornaments.
No, I think that... I have noticed a large number of people buying
like,
new ornaments every year.
That's deranged.
And I'm just like, the whole point is a tradition. I mean, I'm not to go, we should all return to tradition here. But like, I think it's nice to have one. Oh my God, that's the ornament you made when you're 5 years old. Or
yes.
Like, whatever. Like, and like building an ornament collection, like after I moved out and I got married and I were building an ornament collection. Like, I want that forever. And then you pass it to your kids or whatever.
I think you buy like an ornament a year and it's like a special one and it reflects the
and I get at the beginning, maybe when you first start out, like your new life is like a young adult or like you've moved somewhere or whatever, like you need to buy a set of ornaments. But like the number of ornaments we're buying, I don't think it's...
Well, the good news is
30%
tariffs on Christmas ornaments, which to me is like emblematic of they no longer have any fear of like the backlash ruining their electoral chances. They had permanent, terrible fear. And now they're doing tariffs that are like 10 times the magnitude and they don't share that same fear.
But I think the point that it makes about like what I was just saying, though, is that like I have these opinions about what I think are better or worse things for people to buy. Yet I still think as like a liberal, right, that like it's not my place to force you to not buy those things. I think there's like a level here where like the thing that distinguishes, I think, liberal concerns about consumption patterns or overconsumption or you know, even just like the culture that we've built around like needing to buy certain things in order to like fit in with certain income groups or to keep up with the Joneses, etc. Like you can have those concerns and not feel like it's appropriate for the federal government to make you sacrifice these things that you want in service of an ideological project that I find to be like, we'll get into it later, but like I think it's a little unclear even if they are fully coherent in how they're trying to get to their end goal of reindustrialization and like returning to a 1950s economy where we're like just building things.
Right. And not to be too woke about it. But
certainly not.
But
woke is dead.
Woke is not to be too woke about it. But if you were concerned about like this culture of overconsumption, wouldn't you target people who make the most money and not the goods themselves.
Yeah.
It's like this, there's a the very like just weird tax rich quote. People. Right, just tax yeah. rich people. Well, but the quote that Trump gave when someone asked him about children's toys, mm-hmm. and he was like, maybe, you know, maybe kids will only have one doll this year, and that's okay.
That was,
and
you're like, pull that out.
That it was a crazy quote, but it was also just like, okay, but the tariff on the doll is not actually material for a family making, you know, $150,000, $200,000 a year. It is very material for families making $50,000, $40,000 a year. Tariffs are insanely regressive.
He said, and all I'm saying is that a young lady, a 10-year-old girl, a young lady.
A young lady.
A little, honestly, a little at 10, weird.
It's marginal
young
for the dolls.
Young lady is a bit of a weird thing to call a 10-year-old girl. I'm just saying. All I'm saying is that a young lady, a 10-year-old girl, a 9-year-old girl, a 15-year-old girl, doesn't need 37 dolls. I don't think that a beautiful baby girl needs... that's 11 years old, needs to have 30 dolls.
I forgot how many ages he is.
I think they can have 3 dolls or 4 dolls because what we were doing with China was just unbelievable. And I, like, want to, like, now shift our conversation because I really want us to steel man what's going on here. Mm. Because I think that, like, I really want to be able to inhabit the brain of Donald Trump for this moment. And so I would like you to just...
my condolences.
You're in it too, buddy. Oh, this whole fucking room's in it. So Trump has been pro-tariff and concerned with America's trade imbalances for, like, decades. Mm-hmm. Like... for all the flip-flops and randomness of Trump's policy agenda, like, they're basically, like, two things this man, like, I know he believes. Like, one is that, like, trade imbalances are bad. And, like, America's getting a bad deal from other countries that are, like, screwing us over, either through tariffs or through non-tariff measures that he feels are unfair. The second is that he, like, fucking hates immigration,
yep.
right?
Yep.
Won't get into that here. But, like quite literally, I just feel like those are two things where I'm like, this man, you can see it over the course of his life, has been obsessed with this. So, like, help me understand this. Like, what is Trump's obsession with tariffs? Why does it exist? And then also, is it distinguished from the burgeoning pro-tariff advocacy of places like American Compass and parts of the post-liberal right?
Mm. I would say the tariffs and the immigration thing follow a very similar ideological pattern to me. Mm. And the pattern is something like this, where it's like the problem with the economy is foreigners and the fifth column of Americans who are allied to the foreigners subverting the country.
Can you explain the
and
fifth column thing?
The fifth column, basically traitors.
Yeah.
You know, like an organized group of traitors within the country. Mm. And
traitors. Not traitors.
Not traitors with a D, but for him,
traitors! And traitors, actually.
They're one and the same.
That's actually a really good title for this podcast. Traitors and traitors.
Traitors and traitors. Someone get a book on that. but the immigration thing, I think, is very easy to say, to see where he says it. Mm-hmm. It's like immigrants are, J.D. Vance will say, immigrants are the reason you can't have a house. Mm-hmm. Immigrants are the reason you don't make the wages that you should make. Immigrants are the reason for ABC, XYZ. And if we just got rid of them, mm-hmm. we'd be okay. But the people who are stopping us from getting rid of them are the fifth column of, like, liberals who, you know, protect them and care more about them than they care about you. Mm-hmm. For trade, the more sensible people within the Republican Party kind of dropped that ideology. Mm-hmm. But Donald Trump carries it forward. He's like, the reason that you don't have a, you know, good job, we're not a rich country, blah, 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 is because of the actions of foreign governments, you know, foreigners who are mm-hmm. unfairly stealing our market, like stealing IP or suppressing wages to get into the United States market, or like just stealing stuff from Americans and selling it back to us. And then there's a fifth column of, like, you know, large multinational companies mm-hmm. who are contributing to the decline of America by exploiting what the foreign governments are doing for them. There's, like, a weird way where, like, Donald Trump will say this in reverence, and clearly, like, he just wants to do the opposite. It's mm-hmm. not that he believes that, like, foreigners exploiting other countries is bad. It's just that he wants to be the one doing the
exploiting. I mean, he talks about it with, like, a level of respect. Like,
right,
good for
right,
you.
Right.
You
right.
got
He's
one
like,
over
the European
on us.
Union
yeah.
was formed to get one over on the Americans, and they worked, and they got one over on us.
And now
we
it's
got
our
a,
turn.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's a deranged, like, worldview, because it's a worldview in which any sort of positive cooperation mm-hmm. is impossible, one. And two, it's a worldview in which Americans are, like, infantilized, the point of stupidness. Mm-hmm. Like, when people talk about tariffs on China, you're like, okay, you have a specific complaint about this subsidy to this company. maybe that complaint is valid. I'm of the opinion that many of these complaints are invalid and people mm-hmm. like vastly exaggerate the degree to which China is like stealing IP or whatever. But we now have like 15% tariffs on the European Union. You're telling me that like workers in non-unionized auto plants in Chattanooga, Tennessee cannot compete with like a bunch of French guys in a unionized plant, you know, working for Renault or BMW or something. This is the
Americans
people who
simply
are like,
cannot compete.
They
can't. With the
they simply cannot compete. And similarly, where you're like the
French aggression coming from you. First Pierre Poilievre, and now this.
He's Canadian.
French Canadians and also the real French. Wow. I guess someone else has like a totalizing ideology of disrespect for foreigners.
Disrespect for. Listen, I have nothing but respect for the French.
Okay.
But. But the point being is that, like, it is, in the one sense, saying that, like, these specific countries are doing something unfair
yeah.
also implies that, like, oh, we need to, they'll talk about this as, like, rebalancing the playing field. Mm-hmm. But, like, the playing field was balanced between most of the countries that America trades with, the vast majority, mm-hmm. were operating under, you know, trade deals that we signed, like the deals with South Korea, mm-hmm. or trade deals that Donald Trump himself signed, like yeah. the USMCA deal with Mexico and Canada. And then to be like, well, we can't compete under these conditions
yeah.
is kind of like, it kind of betrays like total lack of faith in Americans as like an industrious people.
Yeah. I like want to set the stage a little bit because you said at the beginning of this episode that we were the highest level of tariffs that we've seen since I believe Smoot-Hawley tariffs, mm-hmm. And where are, I mean they've been changing so much. I mean it's what's great thing that you've been doing is tracking. We'll put up the graph on our screen right now that shows like the vacillations. well, up to, it's October 6th. We'll see where it'll it's up to. Now. It'll be up to date. It'll be out of date. But, like, I know it's, like, really hard to give, like, a full accounting of where tariffs are right now, but can you just give a sense of, like, relative to history, how do they look right now, and, like, where you are most concerned about those tariffs impacting the American economy negatively?
Yes. Okay. 3,000-foot view.
Three, not 30?
30. 30,000. 30, airplanes fly.
3,000, what's that?
The like, one thing the French got right, the metric system.
That's wrong.
30,000-foot view. These are the highest tariff rates that we've mm-hmm. had since Smoot-Hawley. Smoot-Hawley is a very infamous tariff package that was passed right after the start of the Great Depression mm-hmm. and only made the Depression much worse. And the vast majority of countries across the world have tariffs lower than the United States now by like an order of magnitude. Tariffs in the European Union are going to average at like less than 1% effective mm-hmm. rate. We have an effective rate that's something like 10-11%. And if you compare to the 2024 import mix, it's something closer to like 19-20%. The gap between that 10% figure, which is just tariff revenue over total imports, mm-hmm. and that 20% of like tariffs compared to last year, mm-hmm. it's basically saying that there's so many things that would have gone into the United States that are no longer because of tariffs. Mm-hmm. And there's so many things that are like tariff-free that are coming in way more mm-hmm. because they're the few things that you can get from abroad. The other thing to really keep in mind, and the comparison to Smoot-Hawley is important because that was so devastating, but it's also like important to remember we do way more international trade mm-hmm. than we did during the Smoot-Hawley era.
Yeah.
And so tariffs as a percent of GDP are much, much higher than they were in the 1930s. We're talking about the highest since like Civil War era when we were trying to raise money to fight the Confederates. Mm-hmm. And where I believe, this is a prediction about the future, but I believe that we'll hit highest on record, something like 2-2.5% of GDP. Wow. If they continue to do what their like long-term plan was. Mm-hmm. People like Jamieson Greer, who's the United States Trade Representative, they talk about getting to like $1 trillion a year in tariffs, and that's a little
in
bit
revenue?
In revenue. Excuse me, yeah, $1 trillion a year in tariff revenue, and that's a little bit like it's hard to tell how much of this is just self-aggrandizing. Like we're going to mm-hmm. do so much, but like taking it seriously, that they would even get to something like $600 billion would be mm-hmm. the highest on record. That's the broad picture. The secondary thing is that we have a weird system of numbers for every country now. Mm-hmm. You know, in
we should have printed out though.
China, it's 30. Sure. There's a big map.
Yeah.
Like China in 30%. South Africa is 30%. The European Union is 15%. So it's like vastly dependent on where you're getting a specific good. The same good can have vastly different tariff rates if it's coming from Vietnam versus if it's coming from, say, Paraguay. And then the third thing is that you have this giant system of exemptions. And this is the part that I think I have done a poor job communicating, but I think also just the general media has done a poor job communicating.
Not me.
About half of U.S. imports are still getting in with no tariffs.
Yeah.
And those are basically four big exemptions. The first one is for USMCA compliant goods from Canada and Mexico. Mm-hmm. What does USMCA compliance mean? That's a great question, Jerusalem. Nobody knows the answer. but it basically
can I go?
Is like
you just did by yourself.
but the vast majority of goods from Canada and Mexico, except for a few industries like finished cars, are tariff free. That's really important because Canada and Mexico are two largest trading partners. If you count the European Union as separate countries.
Yeah.
The second is for almost all electronics. Computers, smartphones, chips, the parts, and like mice, whatever. Almost all of that is tariff exempt. That is a very large amount. We're approaching like $600 billion in those imports. A lot of that is going into data centers themselves.
That's also a bit, I mean, you just wrote a piece about this, so we'll link in the show notes or whatever, but like, if you're steelmanning the purpose of tariff policy, which is to push America to be an advanced manufacturing country and to bring back not just like t-shirts and shoes manufactured to the US, but to bring back actually like advanced good jobs that are happening. And also if you've concerned about, you know, national security, you don't want those chips being made. You don't want technology and electronics being made in China or in other countries where you're not really sure what's going on in those manufacturing processes. Like, you know, there are a lot of things that get thrown around. I'm not really sure how valid these arguments are. But like, let's say those are real concerns to be had. Then like, that's the thing you definitely should be tariffing, right?
Yes.
Especially the data center stuff, right?
If tariffs were so good, Donald Trump would be like banging on the door, being like, we need to put tariffs on the computers that go into data centers because we're missing, you know, something like $100 billion a year in revenue. And think about how many American electronics factories would be created.
Yeah.
But the like counterintuitive thing is that like we announced very recently we're doing more tariffs on furniture. So tariffs on upholstered, these are upholstered wood chairs, I'm guessing. And they would be have a 50% tariff. And the reason that you can do a 50% tariff on upholstered wood chairs is because, not to be mean to people who work in the tariff industry, it's not that complicated. You know, like we've figured this one out a long time ago. And it's, and if even in the sort of worst case scenario where the furniture manufacturing like doesn't move from the places in Europe and Southeast Asia where it's very concentrated right now. Okay. People pay 50% more for chairs. That's bad. I don't like that. But it's not. It's just sort of shunted onto consumers as like a higher tax level. If you were to tariff these like very complicated electronic products, you would undoubtedly like wreck entire industries in the United States that are, you know, you need computers to do software development. You need computers to do this AI training. You need computers to even do basic stuff like video streaming or this podcast. And the idea of like,
we're just chatting.
But I mean, you need, how would we chat without these
laptops? How would we chat without these laptops and our prepared notes? And,
but that's like, it's difficult.
Yeah.
It's difficult work to be like, what should American policy be to encourage domestic semiconductor manufacturing? Yeah. So why do it? That sounds hard. Let's just focus on upholstered chairs.
Yeah. Well, okay. I am going to now inhabit a pro-tariff, pro-Trump tariff policy. And you've pointed out a lot of inconsistencies. And I think the first thing I'd say is that there are inconsistencies with policy all the time because different political, you know, different political requirements, political constraints, pressures from different interest groups will push you to doing suboptimal policy. Like, yes, maybe he would like to do the electronics as well, but he recognizes all these other problems. He's worried about AI as well, and he's making balanced decision there. And so let's, like, put aside, like, the inconsistencies for now and, like, really attack, like, I think the core arguments being made about tariff policy. The first one, we chatted a little bit about this, but I kind of want a more, I think, direct response to it, is this idea that unfair trade practices are happening in other countries, right? So, there is a belief, not just about the specific tariffs, which you've talked about, like, other countries have lower trade barriers than the United States does. Or sorry, lower tariff barriers, lower tariffs than the United States does on them. But they will point out that there are a bunch of other economic tools that are used by countries to advantage their own industries, domestic industries, than others. And so, like, do you see that happening? Why is that not a problem?
Obviously, it's true that it's not like a perfectly free trade system mm-hmm. outside the borders of the United States. Other countries also often do bad policies. And like very, very early in the administration, I don't remember if people will remember this, but when all the anger was directed at Canada, there were these complaints about the dairy quota system for mm-hmm. American dairy exports to Canada, which is a pretty prohibitive set. Basically, beyond a very small quota, there's very high tariffs mm-hmm. for American dairy that goes into the into Canada. And this is a long-standing complaint of farmers in, like, Michigan and Wisconsin and whatever. And I think it's a justified complaint. And if you go into most Canadian stores, the milk is going to be more expensive than in America. And mm-hmm. that's, like, bad for Canada, too. So that is an unfair trade practice. And we are talking about, like, the smallest molehills that are being made into mountains. Mm-hmm. Most of the countries that America trades with, our largest trading partners are the European Union, Canada, and Mexico. Countries that have way more intense, like, labor and environmental standards in the mm-hmm. United States. Countries that we have had longstanding trade relationships with that, again, Trump signed the deal between Canada and Mexico that he now mm-hmm. complains about. The idea that there's, like, a playing field that's so unlevel that Americans, like, cannot compete mm-hmm. is just not true. And the secondary thing that I would say about this is we used to live in a society as a planet where we all agreed that it was, like, dumb to have quota requirements for dairy. And we all, like, in a very abstract sense, economists would be like, yeah, these are bad. We got to get rid of them. How do we get rid of them? And the answer was, like, you have to do the hard work of signing very complicated trade deals with other countries where you, like, mutually lower barriers. Yeah. And this is something that the European Union does constantly. Mm-hmm. They're, you know, signing one with Mercosur, which is the most South American countries right now. They're, I think, signing one with India. I think signing one with Indonesia. The different stages of this. Mm-hmm. They're always, you know, going out because they want to increase their export markets in these countries. They want to be treated more fairly. And they want, you know, they understand that foreign countries want to be treated more fairly in mm-hmm. the European Union as well. We don't do that. We stopped doing that right around the time Barack Obama got elected and the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which was our last major attempt at a trade deal, got totally sunk. Mm-hmm. And so the idea that, like, you know, this system, the global trading system that, like, America, for all intents and purposes, kind of built mm-hmm. in the 50s and 60s is actually, like, majorly disadvantaging the United States because other countries, which are all so powerful, mm-hmm. like, are doing these unfair practices. And therefore, we need to make the world even more unfair in return is pretty ridiculous to me. And the last thing I will say about this. If you had constructed a program, April 2nd, Donald Trump gets in front of all the reporters and he holds mm-hmm. up this big sheet of all the tariff rates that every country is going to get. Those tariff rates are based on a formula. It's just the bilateral trade deficit. If you were to actually go through and say, these countries do more unfair trade practices, these ones do less, we're going to do back and forth. You could make that argument that this is, like, primarily about unfairness. But as it stands, we, like, have higher tariffs on Switzerland, quite possibly the fairest place on planet Earth, mm-hmm. than we do on, like, Argentina, mm-hmm. who is top of the list for unfair trade practices. Mm-hmm. And we used to have, you know, much lower tariffs on Brazil, which is, again, near top of the list for unfair trade practices, than we did for Mexico and Canada, mm-hmm. than we do for, you know, any number of tiny countries.
Well, I think the stealing for the position is, like, yes, you could just do a formula of which countries you can quantify or have sort of qualitative measure of what their least fair trade practices are. But they would probably also add, like, well, Argentina, we're actually really sympathetic to that government's recent shift, and so we don't want to create that, like, they view that as a potential ally. Whereas Switzerland is a nuclear threat. You know what I'm saying? No. But, like, whereas Switzerland is part of the European Union. They want to really push.
They're not part of the European Union.
Or, sorry, they're part of Europe and they want to really push. It's actually relevant for this. They're part of Europe and they want to really push the whole continent to care a lot more and take more seriously the United States' position on trade. And, like, they view that as, like, a part of that broader effort to do that. And so, like, again, I don't really view this as, like, something they've really spelled out clearly, but I do think that, like, it's not crazy if your position is we just need to do shock and awe to force people to the table, which it did. Like, world leaders came, like, cap in hand, begging Trump to undo these tariffs. It's not really clear to me so far how much we got out of those negotiations, but it is the case that it worked at some level to bring people to the table in a way that I think if he'd done a 2% tariff or a 5% tariff or targeted tariffs on specific industries and he gave carve-outs for friends, everyone would have been like, well, this is so rational, this is so chill. It's not really going to be a situation where we need to, like, freak out and send the prime minister.
I think the negotiation point, and this is, like, a tough successful PR coup that they've kind of done, is, like, a real trade deal. Real trade deals are complicated. The reason they take a long time is because they're trying to, like, detangle very thorny issues that are very small.
Yeah.
The Donald Trump, like, trade deal program was basically, like, whatever number that you promise him in investment, we're going to, you know, knock that number down on the tariff side. And the promise, it doesn't have to be fulfilled. Mm-hmm. You know, the European Union promised 750 billion over 4 years, 750 billion in U.S. energy imports. And then they promised another, I think it was 600 billion in foreign direct investment. Those numbers are so unrealistic to be farcical. If the European Union cut all of its supplier relationships with every other energy exporter in the world and imported exclusively from the United States, they would not meet that target. And so it was just clear to me that this was like, okay, we're going to have Ursula von der Leyen visit Scotland, for the go to Trump's golf resort in Turnberry and, like, sign something for a PR event that makes her look bad and make Trump look good, but doesn't actually achieve, like, concrete goals. The concrete goal it's achieving is, like, making Trump look good.
Yeah.
And that's, like, you know, I think that's a bad way to run a country because I care about policy, and that makes, I think that puts me in the minority among the American voting public, but that, like, it's difficult to do those sorts of things.
Yeah.
And the thorny issues, so one area where I think trade practices are very unfair to the United States is on these sort of IP shifting rules. So Ireland is actually one of the largest exporters to the United States. It's almost all pharmaceuticals and a little bit of electronics. And those pharmaceuticals are, like, have their value heavily inflated so that countries can book the profits in Ireland via, like, a Cayman Islands subsidiary.
Wait, pay. Explain this.
Basically, you have, you know, unnamed multilateral drug company Ireland and the same one in the United States.
Okay.
The company in the United States invents this wonder drug that, like, you know,
Ozempic fixes male hub.
Sure. Ozempic for sleep. That's a great one.
Someone do it, please.
I think it's just called melatonin.
No, no, no. I want it so that I don't have to sleep.
Oh,
I think that's awake. Just called
an energy drink. Okay.
But without, you know, negative side effects.
Sure. Ozempic, we invented Ozempic for sleep.
Okay, thank you.
You take, you know, you did all the research in the United States. You take the patent and you legally transfer it to this subsidiary in Ireland.
Okay.
And now the manufacturers in the European Union are paying the Irish government for this, you know, they're paying them for the IP rights. The Irish government is manufacturing the pills, which are very, like, non-complex, or not the government, but they're manufacturing the pills in Ireland, which are not very complex and very cheap. What's actually very expensive is the IP thing. And so now that the pharmaceuticals leave Ireland, they have a value that's like $2,000, $3,000. Mm-hmm. And who has to buy them but the American subsidiary, mm-hmm. you know? So now you make it look like pharma company Ireland is making, you know, $200 billion a year, and pharma company United States, oh, they're unprofitable. They're, you know, they're struggling so hard. Mm-hmm. And this results in, like, one, genuine offshoring. Mm-hmm. People move, like, corporate headquarters to Cork or Dublin for no other reason than to take advantage of the tax system and the free trade in pharmaceuticals. Mm-hmm. And then two, it's like an erosion of the tax base in the United States. These are, mm-hmm. you know, tens of billions of dollars that are, in my personal opinion, owed to the United States government mm-hmm. in a, like, rational manner. But legally are now being paid to the Irish government at a much lower rate. Mm-hmm. We haven't done anything to fix that mm-hmm. because that would require, like, actually, you know, forcing the Irish government to give up billions of dollars and getting the European Union involved in something that would, like, have negative effects on their economy. And so we would have to do something, you know, real as a show of support to compensate for that. Mm-hmm. That's hard. Yeah. It's much easier to get von der Leyen to sign a big piece of paper. And so many of these we haven't, like, Japan's going to invest $600 billion in the U.S. No, they're not. They don't have, like, $600 billion lying around.
So you think these deals are fake?
Turbo fake.
And so let's move on to the next one, which I think is actually a much bigger concern for maybe not I think the deals are something Trump cares about a lot, but I think that what the broader pro-tariff rights community, we should have an acronym for them.
The protectionist right.
No, I want whatever. We'll do this later.
We'll think about it.
But they care a lot more about domestic reindustrialization as part of a larger vision of remaking America and returning the American worker to a version of greatness that they feel we used to have. And it's not just, I think, in their heads a question of, like, manufacturing jobs are inherently Well, I think manufacturing jobs are inherently better because they're tied to a bunch of other things. They're tied to place. They're tied to mm-hmm. community. I think they're tied to a sort of, like, it's possible to have because they're higher income, they can be unionized, that they can be unionized easier. It's easier to unionize a factory in many respects. Then they can be tied to a single earner household, which allows for a lot of other benefits that a lot of more socially conservative people want out of America. And I think there are a lot of Americans who would actually really like that picture if it was painted for them. Like, they do like it when someone says, we need to have more manufacturing in this country. We need to have a country where a man can go work, an honest day's work, has a union job, he makes a fair living there, and he comes home, his wife is able to stay home with the kids. Like, that is, like, something that a lot of people do find attractive. And the path that people take from, like, tariffs to this image is one that I think goes from, if you have tariffs on foreign production of manufactured goods, especially goods that people really, really want, the answer will be that domestic companies will redirect their investments from worse investments, like service sector stuff, towards this manufacturing because, well, if you can't get your computer from China, you're going to damn sure get it from somewhere. So we need to invent computer companies that can manufacture here in the United States. That will require then all of these new manufacturing jobs be created, and we can have a much more equal society. Even if it means that there's going to be fewer consumer goods, even if it means that people are slightly worse off in terms of just, like, the literal measure of their income, they'll be better off because there'll be less inequality, the jobs they'll be doing will be better, their lives will be better. So that is, like, the picture painted by these people. So what is your reaction to this?
Well, where to start? The first is that none of the countries that successfully mm-hmm. have this level of manufacturing output and development mm-hmm. have done it through these kinds of tariffs. You know what I mean? South Korea does not have tariffs this high. Japan does not have tariffs this high. China does not have tariffs this high. Germany does not have tariffs this high. The closest analog to what the United States is doing right now is, like, the really bad import substitution regimes that were tried in Latin America, and mm-hmm. everyone kind of collectively decided we're not good and did not work out well. And the reason is in part, the insight of the, like, East Asian miracles, in part, mm-hmm. is that, like, if you want to be good at manufacturing, you have to be exposed globally. Mm-hmm. Because if you're not exposed globally, if you're not competitive, discipline. Right, you have to have some sort of export discipline. Because if you're not competitive with what's out there in the rest of the world, you become like the next efficiency. You become totally reliant on this wall that you've erected around yourself.
So you don't and you get can't like innovate. Good computers. You get like maybe they're serviceable, but they're like shitty in so many respects. Mm-hmm. They break a lot. They don't actually solve these problems. But because your market is captured, they can't buy the other computers that are paying like an extra 100% or whatever it is on that item, then they'll just still default to you. Mm-hmm. That's it.
And you know, you see this a lot in the American you see this a lot in the American car industry, which, for the record, the car industry had lots and lots of protectionism mm-hmm. before Trump came into office. They just didn't have like direct tariffs in the same way. And like, is the U.S. car industry like very innovative and forward thinking compared mm-hmm. to the rest of the world? No.
Well, Tesla.
Can
I give a shout out to our great electric vehicle manufacturer, Elon Musk?
But it is also like they don't. It is actually also kind of funny that they have this conflict of like they want to be the industries of the future. They also resent all of the future industries. They want the industries of the past in the arrangement of the past. And again, by the way, in the like peak era of American manufacturing, we didn't have tariffs as high, mm-hmm. you know? So if we're trying to like return to tradition of the 1950s, I will take 1950s trade policy at this point. Mm-hmm.
That's going to be the pull quote. I will take 1950s trade policy at this point.
In the 1950s, it was, you know, they didn't change the tariffs every 6 months. Mm-hmm. And the secondary thing is that like you, it's very easy to think of tariffs in the internal model that people have as consumers mm-hmm. where you're like, I buy this thing is going to be more expensive because it comes from Canada or Europe or whatever, and that's the impact of tariffs. But people forget that the largest sources of imports are capital goods and then intermediate parts mm-hmm. And the capital goods is like a great example where you're like, hey, we're gonna do tariffs on the machinery that you need to build a car plant mm-hmm. in the United States. Not all machinery, you know, can be built in the United States. Even people who are like wholly want to be as self-sufficient as possible acknowledge that it's not possible to just like do literally everything. Mm-hmm. And so all what you're doing, you're making it more expensive to build a factory in the United States because importing the capital there would be higher. Why not, you know, bring the equivalent to Mexico mm-hmm. where it's like easier and you're only paying the tariff on the goods as they're shipped up to the United States instead of the investment that you're making in the U.S. in the first place. And then the same thing goes for parts where like, why is the German and the like Polish auto industry so successful? It's because they're so integrated that you can get parts between the two countries super rapidly. And the idea that like we're putting tariffs on European car parts means that you're going to do less car manufacturing in the U.S. And the last thing that I will say on this point, all the simulations that I've seen, all the like models, all the academic forecasting and yada, 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 blah, 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 does show that this will increase domestic manufacturing output, mm-hmm. that it will over like a medium run, you know, over a short run, it has a negative impact on jobs, positive impact on investment, negative impact on outputs. Over the medium run, longer positive impact on manufacturing jobs, positive run effect on output. But almost all of that comes at the expense of construction, mm-hmm. you know, which is the sector in America that like does provide the closest we can get nowadays to this sort of idealized, you know, I go and I, you know, work with my hands in a union job and then I mm-hmm. go back to my home with my beautiful family and children that people want from the 50s. And so it's not
no
like
one promised
you're
beautiful.
Well,
might be ugly children. I don't know.
You know,
we should want to put words in there.
We don't know what. But
tariffs can't bring you beautiful children.
Tariffs can't bring you tariffs. Well, but I do think that at that second point, mm-hmm. you know, you're doing a lot of this at the expense of construction, which is, in my opinion, a more important industry. But in a broader sense, just like delivers those same social benefits that people claim to care about for manufacturing and is obviously important for like engineering prowess mm-hmm. and blah, blah, blah. But the secondary thing, and I think that this should be something that I write at a more long form point, but people expect way too much from trade. You know what I mean? Like it's so easy to blame trade for social ills in a way that's like totally unrealistic compared to the volume of trade that occurs in the world, and also the like massive size of the social ills. Like, why do most American families have like two working parents right now? Well, it's like because of the complex factors around like women's education and the transition to a service sector economy, and the inequality in modern America, and the opportunity cost of not working.
Income went up, so it's like if you can make $25,000 and maybe you stay home with your kids, but if you can make $75,000, that's like a whole different ballgame.
Right, and so we've now, and obviously I don't want to like, say that we can't wait for whatever the impacts of tariffs are going to be, but like. We've had tariffs for now 6 months. Does anyone feel like we're returning to tradition? Has tradition won?
I do feel like we're returning to tradition.
Like, are women leaving the labor force
in record
rate?
Well, I just got
married,
so maybe. And Roger, who was just on the show, also just got married.
I think that was JD Vance. but, in Brazil, which has very high tariffs, have they defeated the scourge of, like, the women's employment? Are they like a hyper industrialized like a manufacturing society? No.
Yeah.
You know, at some level, and like, do they have lower inequality? Do they have at some level, like, trade is this very important diffuse economic phenomenon that people want to blame for these social ills that are like way outside the problem of the possibility, the raw possibility of trade to solve. And like and just the last point on this, where like, if it's just so funny to me, in this like right wing fantasy of we're going to rebuild the country and the family, we're talking about a country that like doesn't do any parental leave or like doesn't do does not have universal pre-K outside of like a very few places. The idea that there's like some grand incentive structure that we the market has put in place for two worker households, and that the government needs to press its thumb against it is so funny, because we were like, compared to every other country on Earth, we're pressing our thumb against it so hard.
Not every other country on Earth.
Okay.
But yes.
Every other like high income country.
OECD. Sure, let's say that.
Listen, we respect the OECD, but there are some low and middle income countries
that are still doing better. Yeah. I do think though that there is something here, and this actually was a I really appreciate, and this is like the first time I'll give props to Oren Cass. I really appreciate when people bite the bullet. Do you know what I mean? Like of like the implications of their viewpoints. I think one of the most annoying things to have in political and policy debates is when like no one will talk about or accept the trade-offs and like talk about them. So Oren gave a Oren Cass is an economist. We talked about him a couple times on the show. He's an economist at the American Compass, which is an organization which I think probably has done more than any other organization to platform ideas around tariff policy, to bring up back ideas around domestic manufacturing as being kind of this key to this better American family and like remaking the American family in a stronger way.
I will add, he wrote the proposal that would eventually become Jared Golden's like tariff proposal in Congress, the version for universal tariffs, and that like went on to shape the Trump campaign proposal. And then when Trump did the like Liberation Day tariffs, like the American Compass people were some of the very few people that got like shouted out by the White House.
And he was a Project 2025 co-author. And so, you know, this is an organization and a person who has been, I think, very, very instrumental, one of probably the most influential policy entrepreneurs right now. I mean, obviously, we know that, as we mentioned earlier, that Trump has been a longtime lover of policy of tariffs. But I think that, like, people often miss that the best thing, the most influential policy entrepreneurs are people who are just waiting for the candidate to show up that will be their platform to victory. So Oren gave this interview to Vox, to Today Explained, where he said something that I think was super interesting. I won't read the whole quote, so I'm going to paraphrase a little bit, but he said, when we're thinking about the trade issue, the question is a very fundamental trade-off between globalization and offshoring in pursuit of cheap, efficient production as opposed to reindustrialization. He says that we made that trade-off in one direction after the year 2000, and it worked. We did be industrialized. We got a lot more cheap stuff. And he says people are not happy with this. Mm. And he says that if you were to ask Americans, you know, would you prefer an economy in a nation with a stronger industrial base that provides more of these opportunities for manufacturing jobs and gets, you know, innovation and national security. But, you know, there are maybe TVs aren't quite as big. I think he says, quote, I think most Americans absolutely say the answer to that question is yes. Now, I think there's like an imperial question here where like one, it's like, obviously, this really depends on how you're framing these like polling questions, et cetera.
Sure, sure. I would prefer good things. If a pollster came up to me and like, do you want good things? I'd be well.
But I mean, I think the trade off, he says, specific, I mean, to be fair, he says like TVs aren't quite as, I mean, that's like a very muted way of putting it. He doesn't talk about like, everything's, you know, like a lot of other goods. We're talking about food is more expensive in this tariff policy. Yes. Like, and we just witnessed, I think, Americans getting very upset about the high cost of groceries. But, you know, in Orenkast's world of, you know, 10% universal tariffs with maybe higher tariffs on China, higher tariffs on some of these manufacturing goods, et cetera, he really believes, at least in his public statements, that there's a large population of Americans who are like, I would take the trade for more expensive goods if it meant that we could have this sort of economy again. And I think that, like, you know, my perspective, you know, is obviously that I think that, like, you know, I don't know how else you can take the lesson of 2022 reaction to high inflation as being anything other than Americans refuse to pay for your political project at the grocery store and any kind of consumer goods. Like, they really want cheaper prices. But I do think there's this is almost unknowable in this sense, because I think it's so shaped by politics and so shaped by how this question is answered. Like, we're not going to find the answer definitively in a poll that satisfies everyone. But taking it for a second, like, let's say there is a large group of people, and we do know there are discrete groups of people, like people who are working in industries where they feel like trade really screwed them over, who would take this trade. I mean, is it your position that these people are just wrong and their preference structure is just incorrect? Or is it just that, like, Orn is misreading them and, like, this is not true, people don't want this? Or perhaps it's that you can't actually get them what they want. You know.
I mean, I think the first thing is, like, again, I do take as given that Americans would say, oh, we have a bigger, more, a stronger domestic economy, you know, more industry, less services, but at the cost of higher consumer goods. Mm-hmm. I think in abstract, Americans would answer yes to that. Yeah. I think the experience of, like, 2024, but I'm even want to say narrowly about, like, climate stuff, is that people have actually a very, very limited
belief. That. Yeah.
Well, if you poll people about climate change, and people have very strong, you know, weak in the United States compared to other countries, but people generally believe in climate change and generally believe something needs to be done about it. And in abstract, when you poll people on, like, would you spend one single dollar? When you poll people on, like, would you accept a higher cost for certain things if it meant that we were reducing CO2 emissions, they say yes. But then in practice, what they think is, like, you know,
they don't even say yes. Sometimes they're like, no.
Well, listen, a lot of people say no. But again, a lot of people will say no to that too for the consumer goods. The taken point is that when you ask them in abstract, would you pay a higher cost? They say yes. Mm-hmm. When you ask them more concretely, like, how would you pay $1,000 extra? They balk immediately. Yeah. And in practice, they are definitely not willing to pay, you know, that much extra. That's, like, a very difficult global political problem, because, you know, we do need to do, like, climate change is a real thing that we need to address. And for this, I think it goes even one level deeper, where people are actually not, you know, they're not going to get the abstract benefits of, like, reindustrialization that they want from the tariffs. And they are going to feel the higher costs, and they have a very limited tolerance for those higher costs. I mean, you can look, there are some people who, like, I run a all-American manufacturing business in such and such area, and the costs are higher, and they make it work by being, like, you know, by leaning into the patriotism of it. But in practice, like, most people are not willing to pay for already existing, you know, very expensive things that are made in the United States. And then I think, like, secondarily to that, the specific question, where you're like, would you pay more for a more industrialized country? Is this, like, idea? I'm struggling to say this.
Okay.
There's a great paper.
I mean, it's live.
Yeah. There was a great paper that the China Shock people did. I talk about this paper all the time because I love it to bits. It's called Help for the Heartland. Mm-hmm. And it's looking at Trump's first term tariffs. Like, what did they help these, like, left behind communities that were on the losing end of higher trade with China? Mm-hmm. You know, the paper, the China Shock papers, you know, even they do not dispute this idea that, like, America as an abstract entity on the whole gained from trade. But they point narrowly to, like, these large specific subcommunities that lost a lot from trade.
Large.
Well,
small
large,
subcommunities.
Yes.
Which lost, but also even but these then, are lots of they people... got, but even then they got lower prices.
Yes.
Even those people.
Yes.
Yeah,
but,
yeah.
The, but these are lots of people in just a raw numerical
yes.
sense.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
America's a big country.
Yeah.
And the thing that they found was that the 2018 trade war did not help them. You know, it increased prices, it lowered production, the retaliation... In particular, the retaliation towards American manufacturers was
from
very
China.
Bad from China. And we haven't seen as much retaliation this time. But like the from the European Union and like they went after bourbon stuff. And but they did find that it helped win over more voters in those areas to Trump. And the theory that I kind of take away from this is like there's an effectual lens where you're like Donald Trump is standing up for you. He hears your concerns and is doing something about it. And it this is a costly signal because most people even who support tariffs understand that it will raise prices. So when Trump does tariffs, he's perceived as doing something difficult to support you. Even if it doesn't support you, it's like validating your concerns and feelings.
Also, the economy just got better at that point, too.
Well, but the point...
By 2018, so maybe they misattributed it.
Well, I was about to say, the point of the paper is that these areas voted for Trump more than areas that had, like, better economies.
Oh, no, you I just meant, like, mean? In terms of, like, maybe they also thought that it had worked.
Sure,
yeah,
sure,
yeah.
sure. But the broader point there is, I think, in the first term, the trade war was, like... Obviously, lots of people wrote about it. I think it was bad policy. It is minuscule in aggregate share compared to the stuff that we're doing right now. And so the idea that like people in, you know, urban San Francisco were not saying, oh, everything in life is so expensive because of the tariffs, because it was very hard to attribute like what was being tariffed and what was not.
Yeah.
And at the end of the day, like it wasn't large enough to have a meaningful impact on inflation. Yeah. We're doing tariffs that like. Even just saying it's 1% of GDP, you think it'll add like 1% or more to prices like over the short term? That's like a macroeconomically significant in a way that like the macroeconomics of the first term tariffs were like imperceptible to the average person. And
I mean,
so I think
paid
that there's
import
like
import duties on stuff.
Right.
Like on clothes.
Right.
You know what I mean? Yeah. Yeah.
So, I mean, and so I just feel like if people are taking some of the wrong lessons from opinion polling.
Yeah.
Which is that the real world consequences of things matter directionally.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people do support this sort of abstract idea that like we need to reindustrialize. I do take seriously that that is one of Trump's core appeals. And they also take seriously that idea of like blaming foreigners for America's problems is a very popular thing. Mm-hmm. But I actually think that like you need to discount some of this. Polling by the fact that like people are not 100% on the macroeconomic consequences of their actions.
Yeah.
And people's opinions of like Trump's trade policy this term is his worst performing issue.
Yeah.
Worst performing issue by a wide margin. And
I
this is
that.
A total it's a total reversal from 2018 where he consistently polled the best on the economy.
Mm-hmm.
People loved his economic results and they thought like he was doing crazy stuff with immigration, and then they also had this like discount of like I don't like what he's doing. I don't like he's making a mockery of the White House. You know, I am scared about the corruption stuff, but he's good on the economy. Now it's like totally reversed.
Yeah.
And so if this like political project was actually validating to the national psyche of like, hey, I agree we need to pay more costs to have more industrialization, I think people would be more supportive of, you know, his trade policy would pull better.
I think that's a really good point. I do think the last thing I want to hit here before we move into the political capture section of this podcast is revenue for the United States federal government. Mm. So we just had a podcast, our second podcast of this series with Jordan Weissman, who is a staff writer and an editor here at The Argument. And he's a liberal who was very skeptical of deficit hawkery prior to the last, I guess, year or so. And part of what's changed, obviously, is that interest rates have gone up. And now it's theoretically possible that the debt becomes a serious issue and also might become a political issue in that it's curtailing the ability to expand social welfare. It is inducing people to go after austerity measures that I think are ones that, I would not support. I don't think that you would support either from your work. And something that the Trump administration will point out is that they are bringing in significant amounts of revenue through this tax. And taxes do have
taxes raise losers. Revenue.
Yeah, I mean, taxes do have losers. I mean, I guess now they're accepting that it is a tax. But I mean, I don't think that we're going to get $1 trillion a year out of this. But I do think it's the case that you are getting a not insubstantial amount. I think, was it $200 billion we were expecting
it's,
to come
it's
in?
It's a little higher than $200 billion now.
Yeah,
and you add that to the previous Trump tariff. So you're looking at $350 billion a year.
So, isn't that good?
Taxes raise revenue.
I'm pro many taxes.
Taxes, many, but genuinely,
yeah.
I remember there's a very funny series of polling. I don't remember which meta-analysis it was, but it was basically asking economists and going through a bunch of papers and being what are the best taxes? What are the worst taxes? Mm-hmm. And the very funny thing about that paper is that they did not put tariffs on the list because mm-hmm. they knew that it would automatically be selected as the worst tax by everybody, and they wanted to get
polling hygiene. That's bad. Here at The Argument, never do that on our polls.
They wanted to get what do you think of the gross receipts tax? You know what I mean?
Add the tariff. What? That's so annoying.
And listen, but my point is that tariffs are considered so bad mm-hmm. as a revenue source that most economists are don't even think about it as a stated goal. These are obviously raising, like I said, 1% of GDP. I think they could go higher. I am more pessimistic that the trade war will expand further mm-hmm. Than I think you are. But the that is still, 1% of GDP is 5% of the
yeah.
Yeah. Well, my point is that we run a really big federal government in the United States.
Oh,
it is still
as a proportion,
not that large as a proportion of overall spending, mm-hmm. and the cost relative to that revenue benefits are really high. The macroeconomic mm-hmm. costs are really high. And the calculation only gets worse from here. So, you have the tariffs the first year, they're changing a ton. You're importing stuff from Vietnam at a 20% tariff, and you got to just eat it because that's all you can do. You built a factory in Vietnam that you can't just pick that thing up.
Yeah.
But on a time scale of 4 to 5 years, we'll expand the factories in Mexico that have lower tariffs mm-hmm. and slow down the ones in Vietnam. On a time scale of 5 to 10 years, you're opening new factories in the United States, but also in Mexico and Canada, places that have lower tariffs than the places that currently have higher tariffs, to try to take advantage of the differential. And so you're going to have a situation where the economic distortions, the real economic costs rise mm-hmm. over time, because now you're not getting the best cars, you're not getting going through the most efficient production processes, you're getting whatever is dictated by tariff policy. And the revenue that you're generating is going down mm-hmm. over time. And so the longer this persists, the kind of worse it is at shoring up the fiscal state. Mm-hmm. I don't it's the only silver lining is that you're reducing the deficit. But I do not think it's a silver lining that's worth it. And the key thing that I would also say is the real debt trap is a growth trap. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
The debt of a country is built on this fundamental assumption that they'll continue growing at a reasonable rate, far into the future. And the worst things that Trump is doing for debt sustainability are the deportations, which just numerically make it mm-hmm. way, way, way harder. Immigrants in the U.S. contribute a lot more to fiscal coffers than they take out, mm-hmm. Especially at the federal level. And then the tariffs, because I think they have a growth impact in the long run that makes America poorer, which is a much larger effect then they'll like,
yeah, because we're going to raise grow X less revenue. And we're less rich, then the tax revenue from other taxes is less too. So then
right,
all of a sudden,
right. And the comparative debt burdens are higher. And so there's a reason why, again, very few countries like rely on tariffs for revenue, mm-hmm. except for countries that are like so low in state capacity that they cannot do
collect accurate income taxes.
Right, right.
So you have successfully beat this case to death, in my opinion, but I think I'm an objective second party to this situation. But one thing that you mentioned earlier, I just want to get into a little bit here, which is just like you talked about Whirlpool, the American, mostly American washing machine company. I think most people have Whirlpools. They've seen Whirlpools around. And
I got an LG, like a Patriot.
You got an LG? I don't actually know what I have. I think I have an LG actually too.
Yeah.
So Whirlpool is suing because it sees a potential benefit to its own business if it can prevent competition coming from out of country. And this is what happens with tariff policy. Tariffs create the incentive for political action by domestic companies not to produce better washing machines or produce better consumer products or whatever it is, not to make sure their workers are taken care of, etc., but largely to see their business as blocking foreign competition. And I think the thing that like has actually increasingly stressed me out about the tariffs is that I think that it's going to be really hard to roll a lot of these back. Mm. I think that I mean, 4 years of these tariffs, 4 years of companies developing the political muscles to try and take advantage of these laws in order to rent seek on the backs of the American consumer and to block foreign competition and not really spend a lot of time innovating. Like, that creates a lot and a lot of political constituencies. I mean, this is something I talk about all the time when it comes to housing and other issues, but this idea from Minister Olson of like concentrated benefits, diffuse costs. Like, how often do I buy a washing machine? Like, it rarely comes up. Like, I'm a renter. There's one in my house from the guy who owns it. Like, that's not something that I have to deal with. If it breaks, I don't even feel that, obviously. I might feel that actually in diffuse benefits, like the rent might go up in some future renewal of that lease. But like, I don't see the direct harm of that. But if you are Whirlpool, you have the direct benefit. Yeah. You're like, if I let in X number more washing machines, you know that that is going to decrease your revenues that year. And so to you, there, and also you're organized. Like, as American consumers, we're not really organized into a lobbying arm. Theoretically, our parties are supposed to be doing that. But like, we're not organized in the same way to be like, we're speaking on behalf of American consumers to do this. Instead, you are hoping that the mass of the elected officials will care about that relative to a Whirlpool lobbyist, or we're like going after Whirlpool here, but like, maybe they're right. Damn. You know, just agnostic on Whirlpool, but like, you know, or any of these kinds of political or of lobbying corporations or lobbying firms that are speaking on behalf of these industries, they have a much easier way of getting into the system, taking advantage of these rules, of capturing benefits at our expense. And so, I mean, like, how pessimistic are you about future administrations being able to roll this back?
I want to say first, I think you've hit on something that we haven't talked a lot about on the cost of tariffs, which is like, there's this idealized, like, what if we found the optimal tariff rate based on America's size to like revenue generate? And then there's the reality of it, which is like all this icky lobbying gets in the way. And we have had, you know, I can think of dozens of instances of like Tim Cook walking into the White House and mysteriously a few days later, we get
the
an exemption
gold
for smartphones.
Bar for the, Donald
the,
Trump.
Right. We have a tariff on car parts.
Yeah.
But functionally, all of the U.S. automakers are majority exempt. They get a rebate. Mm-hmm. If you're a auto repair shop, tough luck, idiot. Mm-hmm. And so like we already constructed this system, and I wrote this whole article about like we have a massive exemption for AI companies because the Trump administration believes that, you know, artificial intelligence is the future. They want to gamble as much as possible on AI. And the idea of like putting a tariff on high value computers from Taiwan would jeopardize American AI leadership. They're picking and choosing which countries to do, or excuse me, which companies to do this to. But like, you know, we took a 15% stake in Intel and they get a tariff exemption. Mm-hmm. Like, talk about stacked deck.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? You have a company that's now, you know, a pick favorite on imports, on subsidies, and on ownership in Intel. And Intel, is Intel a good company? No. They're not doing well on this. But I've talked to a lot of people, most recently Scott Linsicum, about the, like, political, could we do this politically? Mm-hmm. And I am also very doomer about it because, yeah. So the Smoot-Hawley Act, fun fact, mm-hmm. was never fully repealed. When we passed Smoot-Hawley, it was a total disaster, and people kind of finally had to face the fact that in the modern society of then the 1940s and 50s, like, tariffs were deleterious to domestic economic growth, and in a much larger way than during the, like, Hamiltonian era, when we also did a lot of tariffs.
And let's not forget our free trade king, FDR.
Well, they kicked up.
We stand.
A lot of authority to the president.
Yes.
For that basic reason, they were like, the same Congress
authority.
Congress yep. can't. They're a bunch of idiots. Yep. They they want all of their, like, local provincial yes. industries protected. So let's just, the president surely will have all of America's interests in mind.
I will say this. I still buy that in general. That was the correct move.
Listen, I mean, it worked
for like 150
years.
Well,
70. Well, it depends on where you want to pick the starting point. Anyway. But my point is that the passage of Smoot-Hawley mm-hmm. to where America got to, like, a modernized low tariff state was, like, also 30 years.
Yeah.
You know, and those are 30 years marked by the worst depression in human history. The largest war in human history, like the most powerful president in American history, mm-hmm. And then, like, the unipolar system in which we are the largest economy by a wide margin, and because all of Europe has been blown up, mm-hmm. And recreating wow. those conditions Ooh. Are a little bit difficult. And so you look at, like,
and undesirable, I would say.
Well, well,
just to be clear,
secondary concerns.
To be clear, undesirable.
But you look at, okay, what countries have done very large trade openings in the modern era.
Yeah.
And you also have a very short list because most countries are, like, not stupid enough to try this in the first place.
Yeah.
And so you're stuck with, like, Mexico after the 90s debt crisis, mm-hmm. you know, when the IMF intervention in Turkey, the fall of the Soviet Union,
wow.
the, like, end of the import license regime in the Dengis reforms in China. Points of comparison are, like, very dire.
Yeah.
And so I also am, like, it would be very, it's very easy to see, like, hey, Brazil did this import substitution experiment in, like, the 60s and it didn't work. Has Brazil ever lowered their tariffs from that? Not in, like, to a free trade mm-hmm. area, not even close. And we still have tariffs, like the chicken tax, which is tariff from the 60s,
you
from the Johnson era.
I love
the chicken tax. No, I don't. But, like, a tariff on trucks that just yeah. persisted forever because no one wants to change it. And every president could just sign a piece of paper and change it. They don't want to because it would, you know,
piss off a certain amount of people, even if it's small.
Lower Michigan, and it would that would kill you.
Yes.
And that makes me broadly pessimistic.
Yeah.
And I will say, to counterbalance what I think would make me optimistic, the first is, like I said, this policy is not popular. Mm-hmm. People have done this. We've, you know, now tried this idea and people don't like it. I think there's a lot of stuff where any sensible president, and I'm willing to go as far as to include J.D. Vance in that list, that is, would undo Uh-oh. A lot of this. We're like,
you think J.D. Vance would undo a lot of this?
I think J.D. Vance would undo the, like, banana and coffee tariffs, 100%. I think J.D. Vance would, like, undo lot of the, like, very obvious nonsense, and you can get, you know,
wow.
obvious nonsense is a large
a
percentage.
Low
of,
bar for this presidency, lo- aren't we?
Low bar,
the lowest of bars.
Obvious nonsense is like 10 to 15% of the tariffs that you can just like that, and I have no doubt that they will do that very quickly. And the Trump administration themselves have signaled that they want to, like, possibly reduce mm-hmm. the banana tariffs. They put out a notice allowing the U.S. Trade Representative to negotiate them down if need be. And then the secondary thing that makes me more optimistic is, like, okay, let's think about a hypothetical world. I'm just picking, you know, J.B. Pritzker becomes president.
Wow.
Right?
Weird world.
Does, huh?
Weird world.
Why is that a weird world? He's going to run.
I think he's going to be president.
Listen, I'm just picking. Pritzker? I'm trying to pick.
Look at
I'm
Illinois.
Trying to pick the most uncontroversial person in the Democratic primary. I'm let's say Pritzker becomes president.
Okay.
most likely he will not have a trifecta.
Yes.
You know, most likely Republicans control the Senate.
Yes.
If Republicans control the Senate and you have, you know, J.B. Pritzker as president, what can he do to affect the economy on a macro scale? Vanishingly little. You know, you can do stuff like student loan forgiveness, but that, you know, the amount of student loans that are paid every year is much smaller than the cost of these tariffs. Mm-hmm. You know, J.B. Pritzker would have very little direct authority over the economy, except he could undo a lot of these tariffs. And so the temptation to use the only tool at your disposal would, I think, be very high.
So you're rooting for Republican Senate?
I'm not rooting for it, because I think the incentives are only slightly lower in like a tightly controlled Democratic Senate. Like it's very hard to pass large bills in the United States.
Yeah.
But my broader point is just that like,
Some Republicans might come along with him too. They might be excited about it.
I mean, I would not be surprised if there's like more, you know, Ron Paul is like, let's eject the tariff stuff from the party after this because it becomes unpopular.
But also even like that, that with the Democratic president, Republicans would be on board with taking back authority over tariffs.
Possibly.
Yeah.
That's a lot harder to do. But yeah. the point being is like, I do think there would be some greater possibility because of how large the tariff shock was in an upward direction to undo a lot of it. Especially if that's the limited amount of ways that you can directly affect the economy. And you see this in the, like, polling around trade as an issue.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Democrats and Republicans used to be... it used to be Republicans were the very pro-free trade party. Democrats were very anti-free trade. Democrats started becoming more mixed, especially in the Clinton era.
Mm-hmm.
And now you had an era where... Republicans were the more anti-free trade party, but both parties were very mixed on this issue.
Yeah.
The polarization is now very intense.
Yes.
Where Democrats, you know, the Democratic base likes trade, the Republican base does not.
Mm-hmm.
And independents are like, that's an opportunity to say, like, we're delivering on something that you disliked about the last administration and liked about this one.
Yeah.
And like I said, I think this follows this ideological through line that, like, this... like anti-globalists, we're blaming foreigners for everything. The idea of like getting together in a community of nations is the problem. That Democrats are very negatively polarized against.
Yeah.
Democrats are becoming a much more like cosmopolitan entity. And that also means like internal resistance is lower.
I think in many ways, like what you're describing too, is like it would actually be really positive if the fault line between the parties was positive sum versus negative sum. I mean the ideal is that like everyone's positive sum. Obviously we don't want anyone to be zero sum about economic relationships and not viewing this possibility of having like win-win scenarios. But I do think that like Democrats have, as you mentioned, soured on a lot of positive sum economic thinking in many ways for good reason, because there's a bunch of inequality rampant through the economy. It didn't feel like there were a lot of winners. It felt like the even if everyone rising tide was lifting all boats, it was lifting a lot of boats way more than others, such that the relative inequality was creating serious issues for regular Americans earning a normal wage. But I do think there's this like hope here that there's going to be this synthesis in the future of a fair trade, positive sum, you know, liberal agenda. But now that you've ended us on like a more positive note, Joey, always our last and final question. What does it take? It could be a book. It could be a podcast. Certainly not this one. Could be a thing you've seen on Twitter. It could be parenting or life advice that you've been given recently that really ticked you off.
So I've been reading actually a lot more books this year. That was my kind of like mid-year's resolution. And it's been working out great. It's much healthier. But I read a book that was recommended to me by a ton of people who I very much respect. Dan Wang's book, Breakneck.
Oh, wow.
About China. I think it was like China's Quest to Engineer the Future.
I think I have this book.
I was very frustrated by it because it's one of those books that's like totalizing in its assessment of something that's like super complicated. Wang's thesis is like China is a society of engineers and America is a society of lawyers, and that's why they're different. And a lot of it is about like the good that the Chinese engineering society does, which is like the high speed rail and whatever. And then also like the bad that the engineering society does, which was like zero COVID and the one child policy. And I just kind of the whole time that I was reading it, I was like, man, it felt so surface level.
Mm.
People used to say those exact quotes about the Soviet Union. They used to say the Soviet Union is a society of engineers. That's why they build so many metros. And we're a society of lawyers. And I think it like kind of betrays this deeper policy analysis of what is like actually going on in China,
mm-hmm.
or like what the real differences are. Because like China's a society of engineers. That's why they build, you know, so many bridges and trains and whatever. So does Spain, which is not a society of engineers. So does like Japan. So does Italy. Like, is the gap that, or is the gap something in like actual policy?
Mm-hmm.
And then conversely, on the like the one child policy front, like obviously, I think the one child policy was, you know, grave tragedy.
Yeah.
And you read the book, and it's like kind of telling you. I think it's actually the more moving sections of the book were this like very detailed description of what the like enforcement around the one child policy looked like at its peak in China. But it's also true that like there were very brutal sterilization campaigns in like India, in countries across the world, which are not engineering societies.
Mm-hmm.
And so it just felt like you have a loose thesis and you're connecting it together in ways that don't actually satisfy the thesis and don't engage with the like the richness of reality. And I think I'm increasingly frustrated by those kinds of books. And I was more frustrated because I was like, it's not the worst book I've ever read. That there's way worse books that I've read than this.
Not but the it worst just, book I've ever
but,
read.
put that on the cover. But it was just that it was like, it was so recommended.
Yes.
And I felt like I did not learn anything from it. And I think that's the worst crime a book can commit.
Joey Politano, thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me. It was my pleasure.
The Arguments production team includes Ranjini Chakraborty, Isabella Pereira, Angela Tracy, Kate Crawford, and Eli Richman. Our theme music is by Breakmaster Cylinder. If you want to hear more from The Argument, you can become a subscriber at theargumentmag.com.
Looking for excitement? Chumba Casino is here. Play anytime, play anywhere. Play on the train, play at the store, play at home, play when you're bored. Play today for your chance to win and get daily bonuses when you log in. So what are you waiting for? Don't delay. Chumba Casino is free to play.
Experience social gameplay like never before. Go to Chumba Casino right now to play hundreds of games, including online slots, bingo, Slingo, and more. Live the Chumba life at chumbacasino.com.